Well, thank you very much. Of course, I'm very pleased to be here, and it's actually a great opportunity to get away from the rainy and gray days of Germany in fall and be in this very nice place. I'll talk about the puzzles of cerium, copper, gold, and the main distinction between the F electron systems and the two-dimensional organic conductors, the superconductors we've been hearing about, is that we can actually pronounce the full names. There are some differences, and of course there are some similarities. The similarities is actually that these materials, seemingly being three-dimensional, also develop some sort of low dimensionality. And I think this is one of the recurrent themes during this conference, namely the anisotropy of real materials. It's of course easy to treat exactly two-dimensional or exactly one-dimensional systems, but I mean this intermediate region between two or three dimensions, one and two dimensions, I think that's really a problem. And I think cerium, copper, gold actually presents a possible example of this intermediate range where some sort of anisotropy comes into play. So I will start with discussing briefly the magnetic instability in cerium, copper, gold, which comes about by doping cerium, copper, 6 with gold. I will skip most of this part due to the time limitations, because Subir Sachdev will give a talk on quantum phase transitions. I'll just actually briefly exemplify what we mean in cerium, copper, 6, gold by this quantum phase transition, which is a magnetic, non-magnetic transition. And then the transitions actually are driven by magnetic fluctuations, which can be investigated by neutron scattering. And I'll spend some time on actually explaining what has been seen, and where we actually have a further puzzle that is not explained at present. And then finally I'll talk about pressure or magnetic field tuning, because as it turns out, the magnetic instability or magnetic non-magnetic transition can actually be driven by three parameters. Firstly by the concentration, then by external hydrostatic pressure, and then also by magnetic field, and that makes the system interesting. Now there's a number of people that was involved in this work, and I would point out in particular the names of Oliver Stockert, Noam Dresden, who did neutron scattering, also magnetization measurements, Almut Schröder, who actually did pioneering work on the dynamical neutron scattering, that is the energy dependence of the fluctuations, and Chris Friederer, who is working in the group in Karlsruhe now. And we have extensive collaborations with Michael Löwenhaupt, Niels Pieker and Gabe Apley on neutron scattering, with Herbert Willem de Jacquard on high pressures, something I will not talk about, and compressibility. And also we have had a collaboration with Piers Coleman and Rama Tsatsvili, and also Achim Brosch and Peter Wölfle in Karlsruhe on theoretical aspects. Now, when you look at the system at first, that is without gold concentration, that system has been around as a heavy fermion system for about 20 years, and it's actually one of the heaviest of the heavy fermions, with a gamma of 1.6 joule per mole Kelvin squared. It has a non-magnetic ground state because the conduction electrons screen the magnetic moment, 4F moments of the cerium, by virtue of the Carnot effect, but it exhibits short-lived antiferromagnetic correlations that was also established in the late 80s, beginning 90s, by Gabe Apley and Rosa Mignol. And what we found a few years ago was actually that when you alloy the system with gold, then you see long-range antiferromagnetic order. And this is the plot, the nadir temperature, as a function of concentration. There's an onset of antiferromagnetic order when you alloy with gold up to this stoichiometric compound cerium copper 5 gold. And that is actually the one of the first puzzles that is coming in. Well, the fact that gold stabilizes magnetic order as such is not a big puzzle, because it actually expands the lattice and thereby weakening the Carnot effect and allows the magnetic moments to pop up and interact. The puzzle is, however, the exact form of the magnetic order. Before I discuss that, however, since we are dealing with real materials or at least theorists want to deal with real materials. This is actually a sketch of the unit cell of serum copper 6. It has a orthorhombic structure, and the blue balls here are the cerium atoms. It's four formula units per unit cell, so it's 28 atoms. This cerium actually belongs to the next cell down below, so it's four. And the point is that the gold atom is sitting on one particular site, That is, although the system is actually disordered, we're actually up to x equals one, there's actually one particular site that is filled statistically with gold. So the local environment of the cerium atoms is either only copper or copper with one particular gold site, a gold atom at one particular site, at a specific site. There's actually another small point to note, that the cerium copper 6 itself has a small monoclinic distortion, the distortion angle being 1.5 degrees, so it's really small, and this is rapidly suppressed when you alloy gold, because the larger gold atom actually stabilizes the structure. Now here are scans of the incommensurate magnetic ordering, that is nice resolution limited Bragg reflections for gold 0.2 alloy, that is an alloy right here. That is, although we are quite close to the critical point or quantum critical point of the onset of magnetic order, we actually do see nice resolution limited peaks. And as you follow, for instance, this scan here, these two points represent these two Bragg peaks represent these two points in the reciprocal AC plane. And one of the puzzles is, as you increase the gold concentration, the near temperature, as you see, varies linearly, just very nicely linearly, while the position of the Bragg peaks is roughly constant, and then suddenly it jumps at x equals 0.5 and suddenly jumps to the a-axis. So these are the points for low concentrations, and then suddenly there's a jump to this a-axis. And that is one of the puzzles we don't understand. A further puzzle is that when you actually follow, I don't have this U-graph with me, if you actually follow the number of, or the ordered magnetic moment derived from the Bragg peaks as a function of concentration, you find that it is really tiny. It's say a percent or so in this region here, and then increases up to 0.5 Bohr magnitude for x equals 0.5. So it's very nonlinear, and so you have this very, very nice linear dependence. So that is actually the question: how the magnetic order actually evolves out of the non-magnetic ground states is one of the problems here. But this is not our main concern. What I want to do is, in the following, mainly focus on this particular point here. And there's actually two various possibilities to investigate this. One is actually to just look at the concentration dependence around this concentration here, this critical point. And the other is, I said the gold actually expands the lattice and thereby actually induce magnetic order. So you could actually do the converse. You just apply hydrostatic pressure, and you would expect then that actually positioning yourself here and applying pressures to, say, to this alloy or this alloy, you would actually be able to suppress the magnetic order and reach the quantum critical point by pressure. Pardon me?
The TN, how is that measured?
That is measured by susceptibility, specific heat, and neutrons. And it all agrees within a few percent. For instance, in the specific heat, you see, actually, this is a plot of C over T versus the logarithm of temperature. You see the ordering for large concentrations, 0.3, 0.5, and so forth, 0.5, 0.3, you actually see those kinks that you readily associate with the onset of magnetic order. For the pure serum copper 6, you see a sort of leveling off, as you would expect for Fermi liquid. This really doesn't level off to a horizontal line, and the reason might be that two years ago, there was actually increasing evidence that some order which is not yet established might occur in the system around 2 or 3 millikelvin. But when you look at this critical concentration, x equals 0.1, you actually see a straight line on this plot. And that is the signature of non-Fermi liquid behavior, the sum of failed constant, instead of being constant, actually diverges logarithmically with a decreasing temperature. And that was first, this type of behavior was first observed by Brian Maple and his group in uranium, yttrium, palladium 3, and also by Andraka and Svelik simultaneously, I think, in 91, and has since been nicknamed non-Fermi liquid behavior. So when you look at the resistivity, you actually see a linear, you see the onset of magnetic order again as sort of kinks in the resistivity for high concentrations, but then at the critical concentration you see a linear resistivity towards low temperatures, and that actually also is attributed to the onset of this non-Fermi liquid behavior. I mentioned that you could actually would be able to tune this non-Fermi liquid behavior also with external pressure, and that is what is done here. So this is a plot again, C over T versus the logarithm of temperature, and for the critical concentration x equals 0.1, the ambient pressure points are shown here as black dots. And if you take now this sample x equals 0.3 and apply 8 kilobars, and that's the red diamonds, you actually fall almost exactly on the same curve. And if you have take half the distance from the critical concentration, 0.2, that is this data here, at ambient pressure, then surprisingly or not surprisingly, you just need half the pressure to actually find yourself again on the same line. So this is some sort of universality which is quite unusual even for classical phase transitions. Actually is something that has not been explained up to now. And when you actually then take this concentration at the critical point and apply a pressure, then you actually see that you drive the system towards the Fermi liquid state. So you can actually combine concentration and pressure tuning to play around and actually position yourself either in the magnetically ordered region at the critical point or in the Fermi liquid region. Now there's a number of models that have been actually developed to explain the quantum critical scenario in terms of a conventional spin fluctuation scenario, and that has been developed in a more conventional way by Moria and Lonsdorich, or in the quantum field theoretical language by Hertz and Millis. And the predictions are that for a three-dimensional ferromagnet, C over T, the gamma coefficient should vary as the logarithm, and the resistivity with a T 5/3 dependence, temperature dependence, and an antiferromagnet, which undoubtedly we have, should vary as gamma should vary as 1 minus square root temperature. And this was actually the second puzzle, that the cerium copper gold I showed you is a nicely behaved incommensurate antiferromagnet actually shows the temperature dependence for the specific heat expected for a ferromagnet. And also the linear resistivity is not explained in any of the conventional scenarios. So that set the stage actually to try to determine the spin fluctuations by inelastic neutron scattering. And in essence, what Oliver Stockert then found was that there are strongly anisotropic fluctuations which actually lead to an effective two-dimensional scenario. And if you plug in this Hertz-Millis scenario into the particular scenario of two dimensions to spatial dimensions and a z dynamical exponent z equals 2 as expected for an antiferromagnet, you do find the behavior that we observe. Now what are the experimental evidence? What is the experimental evidence for this two-dimensional behavior? And it comes actually from scans, inelastic neutron scattering scans in the AC plane. So what I'll be showing in the following is actually scans along this line in the AC plane, actually in this fashion. So these are the scans, that is the scans along the C direction, labeled L. And then as one progresses out into the A, out into the A direction, one actually sees that these maxima actually become more and more distant. So what one actually then can plot is the intensity profile combining all these data and additional data. One combines the intensity profiles in the AC plane, and of course the z-axis is the neutron counts, and one actually sees sort of a dimensional, these are the two maxima that evolve, one sees a sort of one-dimensional feature, one-dimensional structure in k-space. And a one-dimensional feature in k-space of course corresponds to a two-dimensional feature in real space, and that is actually the indication of quasi two-dimensional fluctuations. And the idea is that these quasi two-dimensional fluctuations are then coupled to quasi-particles with which retain their three-dimensional dynamics. And then this, in this language of critical dimensions, leads then to the effective dimension d equals d plus z equals 4, which corresponds to the upper critical dimension and gives this logarithmic dependence of the Sommerfeld constant, as I mentioned, and also the linear temperature dependence. Of course, the question is, the Bragg peak would actually be located, for instance, here.
It's one sharp peak.
It's one sharp peak evolving out of this linear or quasi-linear structure. Mm-hmm.
What about the b-axis?
We checked the b-axis. We checked in the b-axis that the features are as narrow as in as this width here. So it's really one dimension. Of course, it could be extended in the b-axis, but we checked that. Okay, so the question, however, is how robust is this quasi-two-dimensional feature? Because the quasi-one-dimensional feature in k-space, because you see it's rather wide, and as one calculates the width of this structure, one finds that it's only a few lattice constants. So if you would get with your correlation length much larger than that, you would actually perhaps find a cutoff, and that has not, at lower temperatures, that has not been observed until now. So that's a further point to be investigated further. The question, of course, is this feature perhaps due to this peculiar replacement of copper by gold? And therefore, it was important to actually check inelastic neutron scattering on the pure serum copper 6. And what we see, or what we believe we are seeing, I should mention, is the same sort of behavior that you get the splitting into two peaks when you move away, when you do the scans, and you can perhaps very vaguely actually sort of get also this reminiscence of this Y-shaped structure I've seen you before. It's of course not surprising that this structure now is much wider than at the critical point, because you're far away from the critical point. So this is something the experimentalists should not be blamed for, it's just that you're driving away. And this driving away can actually also be, before I come to that, let me just point out that I think this is a very important result, because it shows that this particular one-dimensionality is not due to this alloying with gold, it has nothing to do with this order, but finds its precursor effect in the pure serum copper 6 structure. And this is actually only due because we could actually now work with a lower resolution, higher resolution, higher energy resolution than previous work by Rosa Menu and Epley. Now the question is, when you see this precursor in the Q space, widened Q space feature, you should actually also see that in the frequency or energy dependence. And then this is neutron inelastic scattering at one of these peaks where one positions himself or herself actually. And this is two scans as a function of energy now for fixed Q value for the concentration x equals zero, that is the serum copper 6, and the critical concentration. And what one sees here is actually you get a very strong peaky structure at the critical point, and this of course corresponds to a critical slowing down of the fluctuations. And Almut Schroeder actually now has looked in great detail at the temporal response, and what she found is that the scaling, or that the dynamical susceptibility could actually be scaled at a given Q point, that is data that were published 4 years ago, at a given Q point, this is again a critical Q point, by a scaling function that contained a sort of funny temperature dependent part, T to the minus alpha. And of course alpha equals 1 would correspond to a Lorentzian response, and what she saw was actually something alpha equals 0.74. And this E over T scaling as such is surprising because it is not supported by the mean field type Landau scenarios of the self-consistent spin fluctuations. And then she analyzed the old susceptibility data we had been taking, and this is a sort of awkward plot, but anyway, this is a log-log plot of the susceptibility, and what it leads to is actually that the same exponent alpha is found for the temperature dependence, for the temperature dependence of the susceptibility. So that means that you could actually, or she could actually scale the susceptibility in a sort of generalized Curie-Weiss law, in that there is a Q-dependent part that is reflected in a Q-dependent Weiss temperature, but all the energy dependence is independent of Q. This was inferred now only for one critical Q from the data I showed, and from the static Q equals zero susceptibility. But then she took additional data, and I would like to show you that in this view graph. She took additional data at IRIS in Dasborough, and actually she found actually a very nice, this is the same scaling behavior that I showed you, and there's actually a very nice E over T scaling regardless of whether one is at the critical point or away from the critical point.
When we're putting a different power than 0.75 on the y-axis, the collapse of the data would be much worse.
It's actually shown here in this insert. This is the best fit, and you can actually see the deviation if you put alpha equals 1. It's really a strong deviation in the least squares fit if you would go up here. I meant to change the wave vector. That's all at, I'm sorry, maybe I mixed that up. It's all at the critical concentration.
It's all right.
Okay.
It's independent of Q.
Okay. It exhibits a cusp, and the cusp is actually this cusp is actually this theta of Q for Q equals zero. But I show you the data. I show you the data, the susceptibility data. So this is the static susceptibility for several samples. This is the antiferromagnetic ordering. This is the Fermi liquid-like behavior for the pure serum copper 6, and that is this cusp-like feature. And actually, if you would do this plot, you would see, I showed, it's not shown here, but actually this line would extend up to 6 Kelvin, this plot with the T to the minus 0.8. No, it's a finite. It has a finite finite intersection here, corresponding to if you well.
Okay, I got it.
You got it. Okay. If you make a one over chi plot as a function of temperature, it's the intersection when you get to the negative Weiss temperature. Okay.
For the critical,
it is. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Sure. Mm-hmm. That's. That's right. This, of course, for the critical Q vector would be divergent, and there's actually data that support this. Okay, so the independence of Q, of the scaling, suggests that the dynamics is actually a local effect. And this posed then the question raised by Pierce Coleman, Chimia Aussi, Catherine Pépin, and others, what actually does happen to the Fermi surface? So essentially, we have two scenarios. Remembering that these quasi-particles we are dealing with, which undergo a magnetic instability, are actually composed objects. It's the sort of the Kondorf electron with its screened conduction electron screening cloud. And so in the conventional scenario, the spin fluctuation scenario, you assume that actually the temperature or the energy scale where these objects form is actually a high energy scale, and this is not affected by what is happening down here. So you have these heavy quasi-particles, and they just, as a function of some control parameter, undergo a spin density wave instability, and in this scenario, then the non-Fermi liquid features simply arise from the anomalous scattering of the quasi-particles by the spin fluctuations. And that gives rise to this enhanced effective mass and this large scattering rate going to diverging scattering rate as indicated by the linear resistivity. And in this feature, the anomalous feature, so to speak, is this low dimensionality, which is not something you would expect at first hand. And the more radical scenario proposed by, as I mentioned, Coleman and others, is that at this quantum critical point, actually the quasi-particles themselves disintegrate. So I had several discussions with Pierce Paul Coleman and others, and I always kept asking what is it? What is disintegrating? And I never got an answer. And because if you say it is just the Fermi liquid, it's just the Fermi liquid temperature, that is where you observe the T-square law. I mean, fortunately, fortunately for me, he's not here, because otherwise he would. Anyway, so if you say it's the Fermi liquid temperature, that's the temperature below which you observe a T-square law that is going to zero, this is just a tautology. It's just when you see linear temperature dependence, the T-square law must vanish. Okay, but then if it's the Kondo temperature, which I reckoned was something he was inferring in the early papers that would go towards zero, then I think there's pretty strong evidence that it's not simply the Kondo temperature. And I want to just briefly present the evidence. Okay, that's the main point. So I'm actually giving a very qualitative statement, and the qualitative statement is actually based again on the Kondo physics. That is how in cium copper 6 actually the heavy fermions are formed. And the idea, of course, is that you have the Kondo sort of resistance rise, the logarithmic rise, and then there's some coherence setting in. And of course, this is just an illustration how you can actually tune that by pressure, because by pressure you're actually increasing the coupling between conduction electrons and F moments, and thus increasing the Kondo temperature. My point is, my very qualitative point is the following. As long as I do observe a maximum, a coherence maximum, this would imply that actually these heavy quasi-particles have formed. I'm not considering what's actually happening down here. This is a very qualitative argument. And so that is actually what we have checked as a function of pressure and temperature. And that is actually the result. So what is plotted here is, in red, as a function of concentration, the onset of the magnetic order, x equals 0.1, the quantum critical point, and then the maximum in the resistivity. And you see there's just, they are just disparate, they don't meet. And we've also, although here this is less, perhaps less convincing, because here some data points are missing, you could always argue maybe it does something like that. But anyway, there's no indication for that. Again, this is now for the fixed concentration, x equals 0.2. We apply pressure, and as I mentioned before, we see the near temperature goes down as a function of pressure, and the very much the same way as I showed for the pure cerium copper 6, the maximum temperature goes up, but there is actually no correlation that you would actually have a maximum temperature going down at the quantum critical point. And from this very qualitative argument, I would say that at least it's not the corner temperature that is going down. The question is, what is the local energy scale that determines this quantum critical behavior?
Does this correlate with this
temperature?
So you would have a screened or unscreened ordered moment or a partial screened moment?
No, because here I'm always working above the ordering temperature.
Right, but the point where this crosses, where the two lines cross, the red line, does this correlate with the x value where your ordered moment change from very small to rather big?
No, it does not. Okay.
So here at this x equals 0.16 with a black line up there. So at low temperature, do you see any other signal of that concentration? Is there anything else that's anomalous near that point?
No, except this very, I think that's very, really superficial, that this monoclinic distortion vanishes at point 0.16. But I think that's really superficial. So the final point, how much more do I have?
10 minutes,
okay. Then I get so excited, I talk faster than I want to. So the final point I want to make is the following, and that's actually the final puzzle. What Almond also found was that when you take the DC susceptibility, and of course you're measuring energy equals zero, but you can measure different fields. And then what she found is when you measure the DC susceptibility, again multiplied with this funny T to the 0.75, and plotted as B over T, then actually you also see some scaling. The same scaling appears in the DC susceptibility. And this really is something very remarkable. And this actually prompted us to look into what actually happens when you tune the quantum critical point with the magnetic field. And there was some previous work by Greg Stewart and his group on the related system cerium copper silver, and also Frank Staglich will probably also talk a little bit about this in ytterbium ruthenium silicon too, where actually very interesting scaling behaviors are also observed. Now again, this is now cerium 0.2, and this is just to remind you, you get these nice reflections, incommensurate reflections, and we just looked at the fate of these reflections as one actually increases the magnetic field. And there's a critical field around 0.4, 0.5 Tesla where the magnetic order vanishes or suppressed. And the system, and this, the field, as I should mention, is applied to the easy direction. And now I show data of the specific heat on exactly the same alloy, actually even the same sample, or parts of the same sample. On the left-hand side, you see the pressure effect, and on the right-hand side, you see the magnetic field effect. So pressure, as I mentioned, reduces the ordering temperature, so this kink actually goes down and smeared out. And as I showed before, between 3.3 and 4 kilobars, there's actually this very nice C over T proportional logarithm of temperature dependence. And when I do the same with, or not the same, when I apply a magnetic field, also we see that this maximum temperature goes down. But then there is, as you get into the critical region between, as I mentioned, 0.3, 0.5, 0.7 or so, there is never a region where you actually see this C over T proportional logarithm. There's always some... I identified that from the vanishing of the magnetic reflections by neutrons. In the previous slide, I showed that. Okay, so there's actually never a region where you see a logarithm over any extended temperature range. And the solid lines you see here is actually fits to the standard three-dimensional scenario of spin fluctuations by Moriya. This expression Moriya and Tokuyama published a few years ago. And this suggests that actually the system is behaving more three-dimensional at the critical point tuned by pressure. So there seems to be a distinct difference between these behaviors. And this point is perhaps brought home, not completely, but I'll show this data, although it's not, I think the interpretation that is not consistent yet. This is inelastic neutron scattering at the field-tuned quantum phase transition. Again, now x equals 0.2. And this is the scaling plot, the Schroeder-like scaling plot done by Oliver Stockart. And what he finds, he can actually fit the data quite nicely with an alpha equals 1, although there's a lot of scatter in the data, and this needs to be cross-checked. So, to conclude, I would like to summarize some of the puzzles I've been presenting, and I would hope that perhaps these puzzles would gain enough interest, so people would actually try to look at this into this. So the first is, how is actually the onset of magnetic order? And this is something that is not non-critical. It has nothing to do with critical phenomena. It's just the question, how does the magnetic order appear out of the non-magnetic ground state? I showed you the jump in the C component of the ordering wave vector, and I mentioned this linear concentration dependence, which is of the near temperature, which is in marked contrast to the evolution of the ordered magnetic moment. The second puzzle is, what actually is the origin of the low-dimensional fluctuations? And I should mention that, at least in this scenario proposed by Shimiao C, in terms of the local criticality, also this low-dimensional is required. And we have no clue whatsoever what the origin of this is, because the system is low-dimensional. And I keep saying, well, perhaps it's that the RKKY interaction is some sort of, you know, frustrated in one direction, but this is just an ad hoc argument, which is not very, very convincing. The third puzzle is, what about this local criticality? What is meant in the theory by breakdown of the Fermi liquid, or by the it's not a theory, by the model of Pierce-Coleman, and what kind of possibilities would we have as experimentalists to check that? That is, how can we actually determine the breakdown of the quasi-particles identity at the quantum critical point? And then I showed you the different behavior of pressure versus magnetic field, which is used as a tuning parameter for the initially magnetically ordered alloys. And this is also a point to be addressed. Magnetic field appearing to drive the system more towards a a three-dimensional behavior, which as such is not that surprising for an anisotropic system, because if you have an anisotropic antiferromagnet and you position yourself just at the spin flop field, the system does become effectively three-dimensional. But this is something that also has to be worked out. And then there's actually very, this is not for theorists, but for us experimentalists, there's really a lack of other systems where systematic studies have been done. There are only a few other systems where neutrons have been employed, and one is, for instance, the system lanthanum cerium ruthenium to silicon 2 that has been investigated a lot by the Grenoble group, and there it seems that the system is more or less three-dimensional. And then there is another system, non-fermion liquid system, uranium copper 4-X palladium X, that was investigated with neutrons by Megan Aronson, and there are also a anomalous scaling behavior with an anomalous exponent alpha, different from this alpha 0.75, was actually found. But that's about it. And we need more systems, we need more systematic studies, and also we have to go to lower temperatures. For instance, the question is this non-fermion liquid behavior we're seeing, is this just a crossover phenomenon, or is it something that persists over an extended temperature range? And I just would like to advertise then Frank's talk on this ytterbium rhodium to silicon 2, where actually the specific heat shows a low T apton in addition to the logarithmic temperature dependence. But as a poor experimentalist, I would say on a sort of more optimistic note, if we all believe in the Heisenberg model, and yet if you look at systems, there are rarely any systems that really behave Heisenberg-like down up to the critical point. In that sense, I think when you observe power law dependencies or logarithms and over a range of, say, 10 or 100 in temperature, this is pretty much, and perhaps there's some, it's not just a crossover effect, but this non-fermion liquid behavior at quantum critical points is a true effect we have to disentangle. Thanks for your attention.
Questions? Yeah, I just would like to ask a question and maybe make a point about this so-called local quantum criticality scenario. Well, it seems to me that in at least one of the neutron papers, I think you were one of the co-authors, there was some omega over Q square scaling reported. I mean, you had a plot of omega over theta of Q, omega over Q square. And it seems to me this is very much against a local quantum critical point. It just means that both the Q dependence and the omega dependence go together with Z equal 2.
The main point actually of this local criticality is actually this separation between the Q dependent theta and the energy dependent and temperature dependent susceptibility. And the question to me is actually in the same vein, perhaps, is perhaps this funny alpha not just a reflection of this, as you say, intermingling between the Q dependence and the local properties? Because if you have a purely local, what distinguishes a purely local response with an anomalous alpha from a Lorentzian response? This is something so the question I would give actually back to you: what is the meaning of this alpha not equal to one, being not equal to one?
Well, I'm not a proponent of from one.
This is just the experimental fact. Okay.
I'm just asking about omega.
Just simpler purely local susceptibility would have an alpha equal to one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's what I got more saying.
Okay, Gary?
Yeah, you mentioned the H over T scaling, and then you mentioned that you can find the critical point at the finite field. So in the finite field transition, do you observe H minus HC scaling over T?
We have not checked that. we should do that. Yeah.
So there's no scaling analysis of the finite field.
No.
So I want to understand a little bit about this low dimensionality. So you say at the critical point you have these lines, but presumably in the ordered phase they're only points. So how do you go from a line to a point? Is the ordered phase first a line? So do you get a two-dimensional ordered phase and then a three-dimensional ordered phase? Or, you know, is the width, if it's just a point, what is the width of the point as you go near the critical point? Is it scale with temperature or what's going on?
We don't know. I think the experiment to do would actually be to take an ordered alloy and apply pressure and do an inelastic Newton scattering, see what happens. But that is below 1 Kelvin and pressure and inelastic scattering. We are trying to think about that. I mean, we're thinking about that, but it's not easy to realize. So I cannot give an answer to your question.
Is the alloy a homogeneous a solid solution, or
yeah, as far as pure? No, as far as we know, it's a homogeneous solution. Everything we did points to that. All the metallurgical problems, the X-rays, and also there were some in collaboration with Doug McLaughlin. We did some USR measurements, and that actually also pointed that there is really a statistical distribution. Like there, in the sand.
This is a bit of the question that we have here. What happens if you apply pressure to the unsettled material? Is there some limitation of ordering during the slipping really
valid?
What happens if you apply
pressure
to the pure material? Can you
move
that feature to
the
higher temperatures?
I don't know. I think the.
It would go to lower.
I don't know. I it's not even clear whether it's nuclear ordering or electronic or ordering.
So this.
No, it has not been done.
But you wouldn't expect it to last a lot on that question.
Okay, if there is no other question, let's thanks for a very interesting talk. And so the afternoon session is pretty tough. I would really ask you to be a few minutes before half past. Yeah?